Comes to Michelle Wallace have argued, this full-on pursuit of the black family all too often served as a vehicle for the rearticulation of earlier misogynist ideology within a widely sanctioned rubric of patriarchy. And of course, this whole discourse culminates in the production of the trope of the inexhaustibly fertile and voracious black welfare queen, which I think Priya will talk more about. In relating to this somewhat lengthy history of state-sanctioned anti-black physical and discursive violence in the interests of family, my point is to illustrate how, time and again, black kinship is constituted as the anti-family, mm-hmm. against which the white, middle-class, heteronormative family is constructed. Yeah. And this is the family with which the contemporary gay rights movement is so eager to identify. These are the folks to whom gay marriage advocates are so earnestly offering assurances that they are alike. Many gay friends and colleagues have suggested to me that we need the legalized status from which married couples benefit. But what does this legalized status truly entail? Well, frequently the concern seems to center around inheritance, land, liquid and non-liquid assets such as bank accounts, retirement funds, etc. And putting aside the remarkably classed nature of these concerns that mm-hmm. Matt pointed out mm-hmm. so well, what we're really talking about is the desire to have the state mediate relations of property for us, on the premise that we'll benefit from this mediation. This argument seems particularly, although not exclusively, flawed in relation to blacks in the United States. Truly, for those whose right to own property has all too often been rejected or denied by the state, and whose own subjectivity has been immeasurably shaped by their legal classification as potential property, what does it mean to rely upon a state-legislated relationship between bodies to negotiate the transfer of property? Mm-hmm. Of course, not all concerns are related to property. Another often invoked area of concern is that of rights or recognition. Before delving into this more deeply, I think it's necessary to reiterate what I hope was evidenced by the history to which I referred above, that marriage has not been a vehicle for the granting or protection of rights for black subjects. It hasn't helped them gain treatment at hospitals. It hasn't helped them get home loans or even leases. It hasn't provided them with health insurance. It hasn't protected them from reproductive control in the form of coerced birth control or sterilization. And it hasn't kept their children from being taken away. So whose rights are we fighting for? Of course, rights are often merely a material euphemism for a larger economy of recognition into which we're told gays long to join. This economy of recognition, however, has long depended on a constitutive foreclosure of black subjects in general and black kinship structures in particular. As the anti-family, the collection of subjects as and at the limit of the human, black kinship structures remain the necessary exclusion on which the white and black liberal gay struggle to belong is being predicated. To put it differently, it is on the backs of the enslaved studs, the ever-loving mammies, the emasculating matriarchs, the absent baby daddies, and the overly fertile welfare queen baby mamas that gay marriage advocates stake their claim to be just like everyone else.
That's right.
That is, not like those bad black families. Yeah. Dysfunctional or pathological black folk are not the only essential outsiders. We could talk about the constantly floating specter of those promiscuous single gay men, or the deep and profound panic around those transgressive gender benders who refuse to make easy or comfortable our distinctions between same gender and different gender couples. This shared, although not identical, positionality at the margins suggests to me a political opportunity founded in the reappropriation of a different term in these debates, queer. When we use queer to mark the lived opposition to state-sanctioned and institutionalized structures of family necessary for the reproduction of the conditions for patriarchy, capitalism, and white supremacy, then what possibilities are opened up for a political articulation of radical kinship founded in a strategic alliance among those of us beyond the limit of family values? It is here that I'd like to end, by posing some questions as to how such a strategic political alliance might approach the proposed constitutional amendment outlawing gay marriage. What would it mean to articulate a deep antagonism to the amendment, not on the grounds of universal rights or in protection of an opportunity that is dubious at best, but because it serves as one of the many contemporary instances of the continual state project to distinguish between recognized subjects of the state and the civilly and socially dead? And what would such an opposition require? And would such an opposition require challenging not only the amendment, but the institution of marriage itself, the reappropriation of family values by gay marriage advocates, and the increasingly suspect claim that we gays want a family just like everybody else's? Thank you.
It's hard to go last because by the time everyone gets to you, everyone said everything you have to say. But I'm going to say it again anyway, because I think it's important. Okay. The Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Reconciliation Act of 1996 opens with the proclamation that marriage is the foundation of a successful society. Building upon this founding proclamation, the law, dubbed by President Clinton as the end of welfare as we know it, went on to institute what was perhaps the most dramatic restructuring of the U.S. welfare state since the New Deal, ending the very short-lived federal entitlements guaranteed by the Aid to Families with Dependent Children program. The 1996 welfare reform law institutionalized a federal block grant program designed to maximize state control over welfare eligibility and benefits, created compulsory work requirements for women on welfare, established time limits for welfare receipt, sanctioned family caps that would deny aid to children born while their mothers were on welfare, strengthened requirements that mothers receiving assistance identify the fathers of their children, and limited or denied altogether various forms of state assistance to populations ranging from immigrants to unwed teenage mothers to women convicted of felony crimes. This reorganization sent a very clear message that in the interest of stemming the disintegration of the traditional family, the welfare state's mission was to police women's personal lives and to encourage, and I use this in the strongest sense of the word, women to trade reliance on state assistance for the uncertainties of the low-wage labor market or for dependence on a man. In the 8 years since the federal welfare reform law, marriage has remained at the center of debates about women's poverty in the United States. The assumption that economic inequality is both caused by inappropriate family forms and might be solved by moral reform in marriage continues to animate discussions of issues ranging from instituting new marriage incentives for women on welfare to continued anxieties around out-of-wedlock births. In the United States, the politics of welfare has historically been inseparable from the politics of race. And this contemporary rush towards marriage must be understood in the context of a long history of state racism. Not only has the distribution of welfare benefits in the United States been organized through racialized ideas of deservingness, but the contemporary attack on welfare has been largely fueled by the deployment of racist discourses about black women. From Daniel Patrick Moynihan's Black Matriarch to Ronald Reagan's Welfare Queen, images of black women as overbearing, oversexed, overconsuming, out of control, undisciplined, and generally embodying an excess that needs to be curbed with state austerity have pervaded public perceptions of the welfare system. From a historical perspective, it is important to note that the programs we currently refer to as welfare were originally designed to support deserving widows. Black women were largely excluded from these programs until state eligibility requirements, like employable mother roles, were overturned in the 1960s. So we're talking about a very short history of black women even being sort of included in these kind of welfare rights. Recent demographic changes and who is on welfare, therefore, have greatly shaped our perceptions of what welfare is all about. Put another way, programs are seen as increasingly serving black women are seen as increasingly serving undeserving populations and as breeding social disorder. Linking perceived excesses in government spending to perceived excesses in sexuality, crime, and irresponsibility toward work and family, conservative movements have successfully capitalized on the racist sentiment that black women do not deserve the same entitlements as middle-class white citizens. Cultivating the belief that rather than spend taxpayer money on the undeserving, it is best not to have welfare programs at all, conservatives have proposed marriage as a means of both austerity and discipline, a way of reducing the share of the social wage that goes to marginalized communities and enforcing gendered discipline on racially othered women. So what does this all have to do with gay marriage? Right. It may seem odd that I begin a talk about gay marriage with a discussion of race and welfare reform, as these two issues are rarely linked in contemporary political discourse. However, I want to stress the importance of looking at these two issues together. Advocates of gay marriage often rely on a liberal narrative of inclusion, positioning gay marriage at the inevitable end of America's long march toward equal rights for all, as we saw in the video that Matt showed us. But if that wasn't enough, as an editorial in the New York Times a few weeks ago remarked, the gay marriage debate follows the same narrative arc as women's liberation, racial integration, disability rights, and every other march of marginalized Americans into the mainstream. Same-sex marriage seems destined to have the same trajectory, from being too outlandish to be taken seriously, to being branded offensive and lawless, to eventual acceptance. This narrative that casts gay marriage and gay rights as a part of the progressive inclusion of marginalized peoples is problematic in a number of ways. First, of course, there is the flippancy with which it treats structural violence. Mm-hmm. It is important to remember that racial integration was not simply too outlandish. Rather, it fundamentally challenged the social organization of public spaces in the United States. Also, racial integration was not just eventually accepted. Rather, the very idea of integration was met with tremendous state-sanctioned violence, and I would argue is still not a clearly accepted idea today. Mm-hmm. Second, the erasure both of the history of racial violence out of which the United States was built and of the persistence of that violence today is a necessary precondition for the narrative of gay marriage as inclusion. These erasures participate in a contemporary nation-building project that casts the United States as a multicultural, inclusive, colorblind democracy, while at the same time solidifying the unequal distribution of material resources and rights. By juxtaposing the discourse about gay marriage with debates about marriage and welfare reform, I want to suggest an alternative narrative for the politics of gay marriage. Rather than being the culmination of America's long march toward equal rights for all, I think that gay marriage actually participates in and reinforces a structure of unequal rights, or rights for some rooted in the subjugation of the rights of others. Mm-hmm. Not only do we hear the echoes of welfare reform's declaration that marriage is the foundation of a successful society, and a gay politics that seeks to have long-term, monogamous, same-sex relationships recognized by the state, but I would also argue that the politics of gay marriage is more materially entangled in the project of racialized state austerity than it would first seem. Nowhere is this more apparent than in an examination of the benefits gay and lesbian couples seek to obtain through marriage, benefits that are perhaps better understood as privileges of a racially stratified welfare state. And here I'm speaking really to this argument that you know, we need gay marriage because we need healthcare, or we need property rights, or, you know, there are all these things you get from marriage, and gay people should be entitled to those too, right? Or, as the National Center for Lesbian Rights argues, marriage is a package of approximately 1,500 reciprocal rights, privileges, and obligations. There are, in other words, 1,500 reasons why gay people need marriage equality. So I want to take a few minutes and look at some of these rights. And what I want to do is I want to try and point out the racialized structures in which they're embedded. Okay. And so my point isn't just that when I look at these that, okay, these are rights that black people don't have, but I actually want to point out how these are rights that are built upon, right, a structure of racial inequality. Okay. So the first set of marriage rights that I want to look at are property rights. These include inheritance rights, rights to transfer property, things like that, right? And Sarah talked about this a little bit, too. Not only does the unequal racial distribution of wealth in the United States make it so that property rights primarily benefit whites, but as Cheryl Harris points out, the origin of property rights in the United States are rooted in racial domination, particularly slavery. In addition, as Oliver and Shapiro point out, racialized state policies have effectively prohibited blacks from accumulating wealth and owning property. And the effects of these policies have been that home ownership still operates as one of the bastions of white privileges in the United States today. So we can talk about sort of racist practices of lending, right, that have made it sort of impossible for black people to buy homes or to buy homes that are valued in the same way that white people can buy homes. And we can talk about sort of the things that then come with home ownership, right? Like, so once you have a home, you're able to buy like a bigger home, right? And then a bigger home. And once you have a home, you're able to finance your own business, right? And once you have a home, you're able to pay for your children's college education, right? By taking loans out against those mortgages. So there's sort of this racist practice of enforcing sort of economic inequality through these racist lending practices. And so when gay couples, you know, want these property rights, right, they're wanting into this privilege. Okay. So a second set of rights that are commonly invoked by advocates of gay marriage are social rights, such as the rights to Social Security survivors' benefits and the right to health care through a spouse's employer. As Linda Faye Williams notes in her study of racial stratification in the United States welfare state, the welfare state can be characterized as having sort of these three racialized tiers, right? The first tier are social welfare programs like temporary assistance to needy families or food stamps, things that we commonly think of as welfare, right? And these are programs that are seen as primarily benefiting blacks, and they're the programs that have come under the greatest assault in recent years. Right, and so these are all sort of means-tested programs, right? So you have to sort of meet eligibility requirements and abide by certain kinds of rules to get them. Okay, the second tier of the welfare state would then be social insurance programs. So programs, and these are programs that are generally viewed as entitlements, like Social Security. However, as Williams and others have pointed out, right, that social insurance programs are designed primarily to benefit whites. This is because, right, whites have more access to jobs that contribute into Social Security, that whites make more money, therefore get more out of Social Security, and because whites have a much longer life expectancy and therefore are more likely to use Social Security. Finally, Williams notes that there's also this presence of what she calls a hidden welfare state that consists of state-subsidized private health insurance, pension programs, and mortgages. Right, so these hidden welfare state benefits are privileges that disproportionately favor whites who are more likely to have jobs that provide health care and pension plans. And generally, these sorts of welfare benefits are rarely acknowledged as welfare benefits at all. So you hear a lot about wanting to get, you know, health care through your partner, right? And I think that when we talk about that, we need to talk about, well, why is healthcare in the United States organized that way, right? Like, why can't we just have healthcare for everyone, right? And, you know, and if you look at the history of it, there's actually, like, this history of the reason why we can't just have healthcare for everyone is because if healthcare is distributed through employers, it becomes a privilege that some people can have and other people don't have, right? And when you have a politics that is about getting those privileges, you are unwittingly or not, right, reinforcing that structure in which some people get the privilege of healthcare and other people don't. Okay? So the last right I want to talk a little bit about is on the issue of children. And I think Sarah talked about this a bit too, right? The need for parental rights has also been presented as an important reason for gay marriage. However, I want to point out that the right to sort of, I don't know what the right word is, but the ownership, right, over one's children, which is essentially what it is, has historically been fraught with racialized meanings. You know, and I think the case of slavery looms as the most powerful example of the race dynamic of the right to have children, to have and have ownership over your children. But even in the contemporary period, I think it's important for us to note the role that state agencies, such as Child Protective Services and the juvenile justice system, play in denying black parents their parental rights. As Dorothy Roberts notes, 42% of all children in foster care in the United States are Black, and Black families are the most likely of any group to be disrupted by child protection authorities. Mm. Okay. So in conclusion, in drawing attention to how the claims to rights of marriage are claims to rights that are generally denied to most Black people and many other communities of color, my point is not to sort of simply argue that Black people face greater inclusion than gay people, right? Because I don't want to separate out those categories, one. And also, that's not sort of my point, right? And it's not also to suggest that, you know, there are issues that are more important than marriage, right? Because it's something that a lot of people say, right? Well, there are issues that are sort of like vital to our survival that are more important than marriage. But rather, I want to sort of point out the conservative dynamics of a marriage-oriented politics. Right? I want to problematize a gay politics that fails to challenge the stratified ways in which rights are constructed and distributed in this country. In seeking privileges that have historically been produced through Black subjugation, I believe that gay marriage accepts and reinforces the operations of a stratified welfare state. In invoking the same language of marriage that has been used to deny welfare entitlements to single mothers and to demonize Black women, I think that advocates of gay marriage unwittingly accept a very narrow and conservative vision of what queer politics could look like. Because I think that it is important to consider the ways that our political desires are not simply unmediated expressions of what we want, but rather are produced in relation to particular social contexts. What I'm trying to get at in this talk is some of the complicated ways in which the political desire for gay marriage is animated by already existing structures of unequal rights and privileges. In a social and political context in which state austerity, packaged as marriage incentives, threatens the survival of many women, it seems essential that we challenge rather than embrace marriage. For while gay marriage perhaps holds out a very pragmatic possibility of some rights for some people, the trade-off appears to me to be a constant deferral of more meaningful social change.
I'm sure there's a lot to talk about in all this, right? So, what time is it, by the way?
5:20.
Okay.
A lot to talk about in 10 minutes.
Okay. So let's start having a conversation and having questions.
Yeah, I just wanted to share a story. I'm a PhD candidate at Santa Cruz, and we met with the Board of Supervisors to try to get the clerk to marry gay couples, and I was the only Black person in the room, which is not unusual in Santa Cruz. came up to testify, and she was referring to an anti-gay, homophobic ad in the paper.